Om Sahana Vavatu Sahano Bhunaktu Sahaviryankaravavahai Tejasvinagadhitamastu Madhitvishavahai Om Shantis Shantis Shantihi. May the Supreme Lord protect both the teacher and the student, and may He cherish and nourish us both. May we work with full energy. May our study be perfect, and may it give us good results. May we never feel ill will towards others. Namaram Vishnu Paraya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Varanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Garavani Pacharane Nivesheshya Sanyavadi Kalsitya Rishatarane Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Garadara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vinda. Okay, so today we start studying a topic that we deal with all the time, quite often unconsciously. We're going to be looking at the three modes of material nature. Of course, it pays to be conscious of them and how they work. It makes life a lot easier. So with that idea in mind, Krishna has included this subject matter in his Bhagavad Gita teachings. So the key connecting, chapter 13 to 14, is 1322. Krishna says in this verse, the living entity in material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of material nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus he meets with good and evil amongst various species. In chapter 13, Krishna explained that the conditioned soul is distinct from matter, yet he's entangled by it. Every conditioned living entity is factually trapped by his field of activities. Burajan Prabhu put it very politely. He compared it to a child being within its own backyard. That's a polite way to look at it. But the reality is that our field of activity is an entrapment. So Krishna very kindly in this chapter will give us information about the modes, how they work on us, and how we can transcend them. Now in chapter 14, we find that there are three distinct sections within this chapter. Verses 1 to 9, which Krishna will be dealing with, or we will be dealing with today. Here Krishna explains how the living entity becomes entrapped in the material world, how he enters the material world and how he becomes entrapped. Then in verses 10 to 18, he describes how the living entity is actually conditioned by the three modes and bound by them. And then in 19 to 27, he gives us clear direction how to transcend the modes and become free of all entanglement with the material energy. Both verse 1 and Srila Prabhupada's purport on it read like a very enlivening and enthusing tonic. Something we can do with at this point in time, I think. It's a good tonic. So Prabhupada is giving us that in his purport to verse 1. So perhaps if Krishna Priya, if you'd like to come out and read the... You got a bad throat? Okay. That's why you've been away for so long. Okay, so maybe Abhadut, you'd like to come out and read the first verse and the complete purport, the first chapter of the first purport.
Text 1, translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, again, I shall declare to you the supreme wisdom, the best of all knowledge, knowing which all the sages have attained the supreme perfection. From the 7th chapter to the end of the 12th chapter, Sri Krishna in detail reveals the absolute truth, the supreme personality of Godhead. Now, the Lord himself is further enlightening Arjuna. If one understands this chapter through the process of philosophical speculation, he will come to an understanding of devotional service. In the 13th chapter, it was clearly explained that by humbly developing knowledge, one may possibly be freed from material entanglement. It has also been explained that it is due to association with the modes of nature that the living entity is entangled in this material world. Now, in this chapter, the Supreme Personality explains that those modes of nature are, how they act, how they bind, and how they give liberation. The knowledge explained in this chapter is proclaimed by the Supreme Lord to be superior to the knowledge given so far in other chapters. By understanding this knowledge, various great sages attained perfection and transferred to the spiritual world. The Lord now explains the same knowledge in a better way. This knowledge is far, far superior to all other processes of knowledge thus far explained, and knowing this, many attained perfection. Thus, it is expected that the one who understands this 14th chapter will attain perfection.
So this purport by Srila Prabhupada to the first verse really gives us a very strong impetus to seriously try and understand this chapter. It's in our best interest. However, I must admit that I was a little bit confused when I heard from Prabhupada that he wanted us to do that through speculation, philosophical speculation. And I thought, what does he mean by that? So luckily, I found a very nice quote by Prabhupada that explains the difference between mental speculation and philosophical speculation. It's from a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Chaturbhuja Prabhu in 72. There he wrote, "As for the difference between mental speculation and philosophical speculation, we take it that everything is known by psychological action of the mind, so that philosophical speculation is the same as mental speculation, if it is merely the random or haphazard activity of the brain to understand everything and make theories, ifs and maybes. But if philosophical speculation is directed by Shastra and Guru, and if the goal of such philosophical attempts is to achieve Vishnu, then that philosophical speculation is not mental speculation. The proper function of the brain or psychological activity is to understand everything through Krishna's perspective or point of view. And so there is no limit to that understanding because Krishna is unlimited. And even though it can be seen that the devotee who knows Krishna knows everything, still the philosophical process never stops and the devotee continues to increase his knowledge even though he knows everything." Try to understand this point. So here Prabhupada is explaining that these psychological activities are going to go on. It's just a part of the function of the living entity, the way our mechanism works. We're not going to be able to escape that. However, if that ability is guided by Shastra and Guru and is with the goal of Krishna in mind, then it's not considered such a bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing, this philosophical speculation. Trying to understand Krishna from all angles of vision. This is actually not so much that Krishna needs this done, but for us in terms of broadening the heart. This is one of the reasons that it's so important to have association with a diversity of devotees who are in good standing and who are serious and sincere, because then they will have a different angle of vision than we have. So we can appreciate and develop a broader understanding of Krishna and his magnitude, because all of these devotees are part and parcel of Krishna. And they don't think like us. They have a different psychological makeup. So it's very, very useful. I'm finding that myself being in Vrindavan, I'm basically very much of a loner. But I'm finding here, just being in the association of different devotees, they think different ways, have different opinions. It's very, very growthful. It very much broadens your heart and your understanding of the reality of Prabhupada's ISKCON and of Krishna's teachings also. So Prabhupada is actually encouraging that here in his first purport. The Krishna is unlimited. The ways that we can understand him and his teachings are unlimited. Not that that means that we just speculate some fantasy, but rather that we have the Shastra and the teachings of the sadhus as the base. And then we can really explore and expand our understanding of things. Excuse me? This is from a letter to Chaturbhuja in 72. In verse 2, Krishna not only further glorifies the knowledge that he's about to reveal to us, but he also tells us the potency of becoming fixed in this knowledge. He says here, "By becoming fixed in this knowledge, one can attain to the transcendental nature like my own. Thus established, one is not born at the time of creation or disturbed at the time of dissolution. So that's a pretty amazing circumstance. We have experience now by tiny, tiny little dissolutions, isn't it? We lose a toenail or something we are attached to, we lose it. Something, some little thing happens and we become so disturbed. But Krishna is saying here that if we can become fixed in this knowledge, then we won't even be disturbed at the time of dissolution. That's a heavy time, the end of the creation. We won't be disturbed. Can you imagine? So it's quite an amazing benediction that Krishna is offering here. So when I read this, I remembered an analogy that Prabhupada gave, that if you have 100 rupees, all your 10 rupee problems are solved. So here we can understand that if we can understand this knowledge, not only will the big problems be solved, but all the little problems within that big problem will also be dealt with very nicely. In verses 3 and 4, Krishna explains how we enter into the material nature. Let's have a look at what he says. The total material substance called Brahman is a source of birth, and it is that Brahman that I impregnate, making possible the births of all living beings, O son of Bharata. It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. So we can understand from this that we are eternally spirit. We're not born of dead matter. But rather, how we enter is not to become one with matter, but Krishna, through his glance, impregnates us in the material energy. He calls himself the supreme seed-giving father. He impregnates us into the womb of the material energy, which then provides us with a material body. So we can understand that it's this is actually very nicely explained in Brahma Samhita also, this whole process in far more detail. But this is enough for us to understand at this point that we are spirit. It's not that we are part of nature. And it's by Krishna's glance that we, as the spirit soul, are impregnated into the womb of the material energy. And then by her arrangement, under the shelter of Brahmaji, Prabhupada uses a very nice analogy in the third verse to make this idea very, very clear, that we're not a product of the material energy, full stop. I've got it here in art form. He talks about scorpions in rice. Would anyone like to explain that analogy for us? Yeah. Yeah. So the scorpion, he lays his, or she lays her eggs in the rice, and then she leaves and goes about her chores. And then those eggs hatch and scorpions come out of the rice. So for the less intelligent person, as Ananda is explaining, the less intelligent person will think, this rice has given birth to scorpions. Why should I eat rice? Not a safe business, this rice eating. But it's not the fact. The fact is that the scorpion had entered the rice, laid the eggs in the rice, and then left. So it may appear that the scorpions are born of it, but it's not the fact. So a similar situation as we're talking, Krishna is explaining here in the third and fourth verses, is that we don't see it. We don't see Krishna's glance. We don't experience it. The Krishna, we are being impregnated into the material energy by Krishna's glance. We have no recollection of the experience. We don't see it. But that's reality. And this bodybuilding exercise is a secondary matter. It's not the primary thing. In verse 5, Krishna explains that once a living entity is born into the material nature in this way, he becomes entangled by the three modes. He says, material nature consists of three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance. When the living entity comes in contact with nature, a mighty Amdarjun, he becomes conditioned by these modes. So we all have this experience to some degree. that according to our association we become conditioned, isn't it? We had that experience. If we're in very Krishna conscious association, bubbly, enthusiastic association, we tend to become bubbly and enthusiastic, isn't it? We're in the association of someone who's very, very mental or very critical, then we tend to take on that feeling. Even if we can buff it to a certain extent and not take on the mood, still we feel a bit of heaviness. We all have this kind of experience. So this goes back to the initial situation where in contact with the material nature, the spirit soul is conditioned. This is the bottom line on this being affected by our association, that we are in the association of the modes for as long as we have problem with the ahankar. I find this actually very ironic that we leave Krishna's association and the amazing realm of Golok because we want to enjoy independently from Krishna. We want to be the controller. We want freedom. But we end up in a very opposite position. We end up actually in a worse position as almost a prisoner of the material energy. So I find this is sort of like the root of a lot of our perplexities is that we blew it. They put it wrong, you know, very simply. That we wanted freedom to control and enjoy. But by separating ourselves from Krishna, where we had that right within a certain, you know, limit, we put ourselves in a situation where we're completely bound. And not only bound, but completely in illusion. It's such a source of suffering. We don't even know who we are. And not only do we not know who we are, but we are living someone we're not. So the whole situation makes for quite a difficult and perplexing circumstance. In verses 6 to 8, Krishna explains how each of the three modes condition the living entity. In essence, we learn from Prabhupada's purports that the mode of goodness, in that mode, the mode of goodness, we are happy. In the mode of passion, we're very active. And in the mode of ignorance, we feel helpless. This we can understand from the second sentence of his verse 6 purport. So this is in a nutshell. If we're dominated predominantly by goodness, we'll be happy. If we're predominantly dominated by passion, we'll always be very active. And if we're more dominated by ignorance, we'll always be feeling very helpless. Things aren't going right. I can't do this, can't do that. What's wrong with this? This is mode of ignorance. So in verse 6, Krishna tells us how the mode of goodness binds. We may think, well, mode of goodness, why would that bind? But it seems that it is quite a powerful chain that it places around our necks. Let's see what Krishna says. O sinless one, the mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating, and it frees one from all sinful reactions. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. So it would seem that the mode of goodness, nothing wrong with that. It's purifying, it's illuminating, no problem, that's wonderful. But then attachment to that mode, that creates problems. It's significant that in this verse, Krishna, what does he say here? Yeah, in the last line he says, Jnana Sangena Chanagaha. So what he's saying here, this Anaga, O sinless one, this is a name that he's calling Arjuna in this verse. And it's significant because the two sins of one in the mode of goodness are attachment to happiness. This is one. And the other is attachment to knowledge. So these are the two sins of one in goodness. It's not that happiness and knowledge in and of themselves are a problem, but rather it's our attachment to them that generates difficulties. Previously, as we saw in chapter 1 and 2, Arjuna, he was attached to being happy. He had an idea of what happiness was too. And he was very busy giving Shastric references to Krishna about why what he wanted to do was the best thing to do, wasn't it? So he's also very attached to his idea of what knowledge was. But now, in this, by the time we've come to this 14th chapter, he's been freed of these illusions and these attachments. The anattas are gone. And so Krishna now calls him Anaga, or a sinless one. So attachment to happiness, this is very important. This attachment to mode of goodness is something that we have to deal with very much as devotees, because most of us came from vikarmic backgrounds, impious backgrounds. So as we talk to the devotional process, we started to feel some peace, isn't it? Some sanity by following the process. And for those of us who do become or come to the platform of goodness within devotional service, there is a tendency to be happy to stay there. Things are going nicely. What we knew of religion before we met Srila Prabhupada was that religion means we get what we want, isn't it? Piety brings good result. So then there's a subconscious understanding that I've got what I want. I'm peaceful, I'm happy, everything's working in my favor, things are going smoothly. So then there's a tendency to be complacent once we come to this mode. And there's a tendency not to want to preach. Preaching is an austerity. Preaching means you have to deal with people in the lower modes. Circumstances in the lower modes. So those, I remember when I took initiation from Hare Keshwami, I was very much attached to the mode of goodness. It's been my prediction, my problem for a long time, basically this birth. And the first thing he did was instruct me to go and do a 1-month collection marathon in Bara Bazaar in Calcutta. It is the most hellish place. It is the most hellish place. It's so congested, and it's a big, big market area. And the trucks, constantly trucks going through, to the point, so many trucks and so much load of goods coming in, that this huge area, it's about 17 square kilometers of just huge wholesale marketing area. And it's so heavy that the whole earth tremors with the movement of these trucks. So you're walking on it, and you know, by the end of the day, in a place like that, you're just like this, you know. And also, like it's the filthiest place. You know, people, there's no public toilets or anything like that, so the stairwells are full of stool and urine and the stench of it. And on top of that, everybody's busy with making money, so they really don't want to talk to you. You know, it's a very intense place. And on top of all of that, and I realized this was his purpose in sending me into the hell of Calcutta, was that there's been some very bad preaching done there by ISKCON devotees. And they've created a lot of bad blood in that area. So it was nothing unusual to have doors slammed in your face. So doing this for a month every day, it really shook me out of my complacency and of the mode of goodness. And I had a lot of realizations from doing that. And especially I had realization of what an amazing personality Prabhupada was. And any sincere preacher is, that they have the wealth of Krishna consciousness. They have everything set up to live very nicely in Krishna consciousness, but they risk their own sanity, risk their own comfort to preach. So this is something that we, if we come to goodness, we'll have to deal with this. There are other things that are more subtle but very, very dangerous, especially in relation to our dealings with devotees. And that is that attachment to happiness and a feeling that you're superior to others because you're in knowledge. You're not so much troubled by the problems that come with the lower modes. The mind is not such a problem like that. So this breeds an intolerance of others, those who have problems. It breeds an intolerance, and it also breeds a critical mentality. You're not having problems. You're in the mode of goodness. Everything is nicely situated. The mind is not such a disturbance. You know the shastric reason for things. You're happy with it. So when other people come to you, they're in a mental condition, you're really very disturbed, they can't seem to get anything through to them that makes sense, or the circumstances, you tend to be very intolerant, very hard-hearted, and to develop a critical mentality. Why can't you deal with this? It's a simple thing. Why can't you deal with it? You know. And sometimes we find that Krishna puts us into difficulties to make us aware of how difficult it is to be governed by the lower modes. Then we can learn some compassion, we can learn some softness in dealing with other devotees. You wanted to say something? Are you? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's a very interesting point, because externally, mode of ignorance and mode of goodness can look very similar in terms of everything is, you know, pretty peaceful. But the internal workings of it are very different. And Kapila Dev goes into quite some explanation of that in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he points out those traits or those symptoms of a devotee working in the mode of ignorance, which make it very clear that they are very different. Like that. But this idea of being superior is very much an aspect of mode of goodness. And it's interesting what you're saying, because both of these qualities, and attachment to knowledge, which is another sin of being attached to the mode of goodness, it breeds pride. So we see that what's coming out of these attachments is lower mode qualities, isn't it? So even though we are situated in goodness, if we're not properly situated in goodness as a servant of the Parampara, Guru and the Parampara, then these qualities will lead to our fall down into ignorance. So then the mode is pretty useless to us. And as I said before, these attachments in the mode of goodness are very dangerous for us, especially as devotees, because they will lead to offensive behavior and mentality. So we have to be very, very careful. If we are blessed to have, you know, the mode of goodness as our prominent mode, then we should use that as a base to become more compassionate towards others, more understanding of others, rather than to use it as a position of safety to protect our own interests. You know? We should use it as a base to extend ourselves to others. Verse 7 is very interesting. Here Krishna explains how the nature of the mode of passion. The mode of passion is born of unlimited desires and longings, O son of Kunti. And because of this, the embodied living entity is bound to material fruitive actions. So this one, we find that there's a very important word in this verse. It's ragatmakam. So we understand that this mode is born of desire, unlimited desiring or lust. So this is a very prominent mode in Kali Yuga. It's very, very difficult to escape dealing with this mode in day-to-day life. And Prabhupada, he speaks quite a lot about modern society in this purport. Govinda, would you like to come out and read the purport?
The mode of passion is characterized by the attraction between man and woman. Woman has attraction for man, and man has attraction for woman. This is called the mode of passion. And when the mode of passion is increased, man develops the hankering for material enjoyment. He wants to enjoy sense gratification. For sense gratification, a man, in the mode of passion, wants some honor in society or in the nation, and he wants to have a happy family with nice children, wife and house. These are the products of mode of passion. As long as one is hankering after those things, he has to work very hard. Therefore, it is clearly stated here that he becomes associated with the fruits of his activities and thus becomes bound by such activities. In order to please his wife, children and society, and to keep up his prestige, one has to work. Therefore, the whole material world is more or less in the mode of passion. Modern civilization is considered to be advanced in the standard of the mode of passion.
So this is a very amazing circumstance where the whole of materialistic society is actually based on this mode. It's incredible what Prabhupada is saying here, that this attraction between man and woman is the basis of the whole thing, how it snowballs. You have to work hard, as Prabhupada says here, to maintain all of this. And what are you maintaining in essence? It's not really the family and the wife. That's a secondary feature. What you're really maintaining is your desires. You have unlimited desires for things. Your wife and family are part of that desiring process and fulfilling those desires. But the essence is that you have unlimited desires. So it reminds me of that analogy of the donkey with a carrot in front of its nose. Constantly, constantly, constantly chasing this carrot. You know, it's right in front of your nose. You can't understand that it's permanently in front of your nose. It's been placed there. There's plenty of grass on either side to eat. But no, I want that carrot. I want that carrot. Huh? So you're running like an ass your whole life. Whole life. I want, I want, I want. So this is in something that we can understand about the nature of passion, that if we find ourselves constantly troubled by desires, I want this, I want that, then we can understand that we have to deal with this mode. Mode of goodness in essence means that you can give up the desire to desire. You just decide, I don't need these things. I can be peaceful and happy with what I've got. So this giving up the desire to desire, this is the key. If you want to transcend passion and move on to goodness, you have to give up the desire to desire. Okay. In verse 8, Krishna and Prabhupada tell us of the hellish conditioning created by ignorance. I have a read of what they say here. O son of Bharat, know that the mode of darkness, born of ignorance, is a delusion of all embodied living entities. The results of this mode are madness, indolence, and sleep, which bind the conditioned soul. Then Prabhupada in his purport, we start about three lines down. The mode of ignorance is just the opposite of the mode of goodness. In the mode of goodness, by development of knowledge, one can understand what is what. But the mode of ignorance is just the opposite. Everyone under the spell of the mode of ignorance becomes mad, and the madman cannot understand what is what. Instead of making advancement, one becomes degraded. So, I don't know about you, but there are many incidences also, actually not the society so much as the byproducts of the society we live in, which are very much indicative of this mode. For example, have you ever thought seriously about traveling in a vehicle that is made of aluminium? The shell of it is made of aluminium at a speed of 120 on a highway. Isn't that insane? The illusion that I am, you know, I'm in control, I'm protected. Even these big, big buses that we think are so, you know, like safe to travel on, they're made of aluminium. You know, we put ourselves in these tin cans in the air. I mean, isn't it? We take it as everyday life, but when you stop to think about it, I quite often find myself thinking like this, especially when I get into an Indian bus, especially a Bengal bus, you know, insane situation. But, you know, like this, they're tin cans, and we're putting ourselves at risk by, like this. It's complete ignorance. I wasn't there, but I remember reading about Calcutta in the early 1900s. And cars had just come into fashion in Europe and in England. And Calcutta was still using horses. And then there was a big protest, these horses, you know, they're so unclean. All the streets are lined with horse dung. It's terrible. I mean, these cars are so clean, you know, we should use cars. So then gradually, they outlawed the use of horses on the roads, and they brought in cars. But now, today, Statesman, one of the newspapers in Calcutta, they did a survey, like a control check on the pollution in Calcutta. And they found that driving in peak hour traffic in Calcutta is the equivalent of smoking 70 cigarettes a day in terms of the carcinogenic effect of the fumes. You know, so this is typical mode of ignorance, that we don't, you know, can't see any further than the front of our nose. And we make our plans and think this is wonderful, horses pass stalls, so we won't use horses, we use these machines. Of course we won't do any lead checking on the petrol or anything like that, you know, whatever goes in India. And then the result is that the fume is so heavy that it's, you know, very dangerous for health. So we can see many aspects of our consumer society, our materialistic society are like that. For example, these sweets that are sold in Braj with a silver paper on them. That paper, there was an article written on it in the Swiss magazine a couple of years ago. That paper is actually compressed like that through between layers of pig intestine. It's not vegetarian. So, you know, so many things. And violet crumble bars have got aluminium in them so that they stay fresh-looking and tasting. Violet crumble, it was a fad a few years back, one of the latest Cadbury sweets. And chocolate, Cadbury chocolate has also got aluminium in it to keep it fresh on the shelves for 6 months, tastes good after 6 months. You know, all of these things that are there, it's all mode of ignorance. And we're going to have a bit deeper look at this tomorrow. And we'll look at the verses we study tomorrow in light of Uddhava Gita, where we will go into it a bit deeper, the influence of our environment, what we eat, how we do things like that. So we are basically living in a world that is, you know, in terms of the essence of it is this man-woman attraction and everything that comes from that, which is passion. But a lot of the byproducts of it are ignorance, and we are living with it. Until about a year and a half ago, milk in America wasn't vegetarian. They had cod liver oil in it, you know, for the health of the babies and things. So it wasn't vegetarian. They changed it. There was some legislation, to change that, yeah. So it's, you know, like, it's in a mad situation. In verse 9, Krishna summarizes verses 6 to 8. There he says, "O son of Bharat, the mode of goodness conditions one to happiness, passion conditions one to fruitive action, and ignorance covering one's knowledge binds one to madness." So we have to remember here what kind of madness we mean. We're not necessarily saying that someone's going to be in a mad house, but rather, this is verse 9, but rather they just can't understand what is what and who is who. They just got everything back to front. We'll learn more about that in the 17th and 18th chapters. So in essence, what Krishna is saying here is that if we're contaminated by goodness, we can use goodness. There's no problem. It's the best mode to use if you're practicing devotional service. It is the best mode to use. Even if you're a manager, it's the best mode to use. But if we're contaminated by it, conditioned by it, it means that we'll be too self-satisfied to hear super song. Won't want to wake up. We'll be too self-satisfied to hear super song. Like Indra, when he became pig. And, you know, Krishna made so many attempts to bring him back to him. But no, he's always very satisfied. Of course, that was ignorance. But here we're talking that kind of conditioning that mode of goodness will give us, that we'll be too self-satisfied to hear super soul. You see this with people who are highly cultured. I remember when I was last in Bangalore, preaching there to a very, very wealthy family, one of the wealthiest families in Bangalore. And they have, you know, everything is very, very cultured. They live a very mode of goodness, regulated life, live according to the Vedas. They see no need for anything but a puppet-type guru. They don't see any need for parampara, you know. So they're too comfortable. They're too self-satisfied to hear super song. And then one who's contaminated by passion, there's so many other voices of desire there, he can't hear super song. So many other desires. I want this, I want that. Why don't you do this? So many other voices to compete with super soul. So he just can't hear. And then the mode of ignorance, he's just even if he super soul spoke, he wouldn't understand who it was that was speaking. You know, he's a mad person. He's ignorant. I found something interesting in Nectar of Devotion. It's on page 107. And there Prabhupada says, "For persons who are not inclined to clean the dust from their hearts and who want to keep things as they are, it is not possible to derive the transcendental result of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra." So I found this very interesting, regardless of which mind, which mode is binding, that if we are happy to keep things as they are, then we won't get the transcendental effect of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. we have to be prepared to change our mindset, change our conditioning, take the risk of being purified. So I find these are only introductory verses to the modes, but already we have enough to do a solid check on our own hearts and see what is our state at this point in time. Any questions on anything I've said this morning? Yeah. I see. That's a nice question. Lila Madhuri is asking, in which way does this attachment to knowledge of one who's in goodness manifest? Why is it a problem? Knowledge, as I said earlier, itself is not the problem. But our attachment to it means that we have accepted it as part of our ego. It's an extension of us. So by showing my knowledge, I can get many, many facilities, both subtle and gross. I can be respected by others. I can feel superior to others. I can get the best out of what's available by knowing how to work the material energy according to the Vedas. It's a very subtle thing, but it's very crippling. That's why we have to be very, very careful that we use the modes in Krishna's service. Nothing wrong with the modes. They're created by Krishna. We can use all of the modes in Krishna's service. For example, you may be a Brahmani cooking for Radha Shyam. Okay? You're cooking for Radha Shyam. Now, you're a Brahmani. Your main quality, you're governed mainly by goodness. But when you go into that kitchen, you're going to engage passion. You're going to engage ignorance. You're destroying a cauliflower. You are cutting it up. This is mode of ignorance. Then you're going to light a fire, a flame, and you're going to cook. This is mode of passion. So it's very, very important. Actually, I should have made this point earlier. It's very, very important to understand that there's nothing wrong with the modes. Each of their modes have their place. They have their place. We can utilize all of the modes for different purposes in our daily life. But our attachment to them, this is a problem. And this is a problem that Krishna is going to address in this chapter. That, okay, the modes are there. We need them to function, to do different things that we have to do in a day. But this idea of being attached to them is not a good idea, so I'll teach you how to not be attached to them. This will be happening here. Is that okay? Any other questions on anything I said? Yeah. Yeah, actually, there are different realms of reality. I also have some friends like that, but they're amazing people. And we basically do live in our own karma bubbles. You know, we do, in effect, create our own reality. You know, I've been in a building, you know, same building as a woman that was murdered, and, you know, and I slept peacefully and woke up next morning and found out about it. So, you know, like, we do live in our own world, basically, that's created by our karma and our circumstances at this point in time. So sometimes, you know, the mode of goodness is very, very, very wonderful, and we can't separate study of the modes from the reality of the process of devotional service that we're going through. So as we come up through the higher stages of bhakti, you know, I mean, at the moment we're struggling with the, you know, heavy waves of anatta and the vritti, but there, because we're following it sincerely, we will come to a point, we get to nistha, then things will move very quickly. You know, people that are on the level of bhav, they use mode of goodness as their medium, and basically they don't read newspapers. You know, they don't read newspapers, they don't know what's happening, they have no interest in what's happening. Their only interest, the latest news for them is, you know, what's Radha Krishna, Radha Shyam wearing today, and you know, what scent did they use this morning? You know, that's the reality for them. Hare Krishna, please come. So, you know, like, you have to look at it. Don't ever separate, when you're studying these kind of things, don't ever separate it from the different levels of the process of devotional service, you know. Because, for example, Prabhupada Sannyas Guru, Keshava Maharaj, he was, you know, an amazing personality. And he was so absorbed in Nam Bhajan that there were times where he went months without taking a bath. He just went completely internal. He just shut down everything. So, you know, like, you're just going to say, well, he's in the mode of ignorance. I don't want to associate with him. You know? So this is an important point, that we have to realize that the modes are subsidiary to the devotional service. And why Krishna is spending so much time on them here is at this point in time we're very much affected by duality, very much affected by the modes, so he's trying to help us over these difficulties. So, you know, we may want, if we have a friend like that, we may like to practice being in a higher mode by taking their association when we feel we can handle it. It may be good for us to take their association. You know, being real, you know, in the mode of passion, it's not such a high taste as being real in the mode of goodness and beyond. So, you know, things seem to work out for those people. They may be completely incompetent in the material realm, but things still seem to work out. You know? So there is a higher hand involved by the look of it. You want to say something? Okay, sounds interesting. Yeah. There are different angles of vision we can look at it from, and it is a fact that we are dysfunctional. We're, you know, in the material realm, and it's not where we belong. So definitely, we are dysfunctional, and we do bring these difficulties with us into the movement. And that's why it's so essential that there be proper education and training for devotees that is ongoing, not 6 months bhakti program and finished. But rather, you know, that it should be an ongoing thing, so that as different things come up within us that we have to deal with, then we have the understanding and we have the support of, you know, intelligent devotee association to deal with it. For example, I'll give you one. Someone who comes with an impersonalistic background. I mean, really, they practice impersonalism in their previous lives, this life or whatever. They come into the movement. They have all the signs of an advanced devotee. They're very austere, very regulated, sense-controlled, all these kind of things. Looks wonderful. But it's a very deep-rooted anatta. And it can mean that you just keep coming back and coming back and coming back unless you deal with it. It's just one example. There are hundreds of examples. Most of the ones that we take note of are the gross ones, the ones that are coming from, like, you know, solid passion and ignorance, you know, sex desire and like that. Those also have to be dealt with. But these subtle ones are the really insidious ones that you can pass as a very advanced devotee, but actually you're just an impersonalist. You know? So it is true. We are dysfunctional. If we weren't dysfunctional, we wouldn't be here. But, you know, we should deal with that through Prabhupada's teachings. If I am of this nature, what does it mean? What can I learn from it here? We should dissociate. Remember that it's not us. It's something on us. It's a covering on us. It's not us. So we should be able to divorce ourselves from it. Say, oh, very interesting. Let's have a deeper look at this. Huh? Like that. If we can do that, then we're halfway there. If we can divorce ourselves from what we think is us at this point in time, put it out front, put it on the table, and have a good look at it, then we're halfway there. Well, yeah. The thing that we always have to keep to the forefront when we're dealing with things is that what we're calling personality at this point in time is a conditioned personality. It's not really us. It has to be dealt with, especially because it's springing basically from the mind, and the mind can create havoc in our spiritual life if we're not careful in how we deal with it. But we should keep in mind that this is not really me. We should be able to put it out front. We should be able to look at it objectively and not be too bruised when people say, hey, you know, maybe there's something wrong here. Maybe you should rethink this. We should be able to deal with it objectively, isn't it? If I take off this garland and put it over there and somebody treads on it, I mean, I'll rephrase that because it's maha. Someone else picks it up. Would I be too upset? But because I think that, you know, this is me and my ideas and everything, it's all me and I'm pretty wonderful. Then if somebody says something about it or tries to correct it, deal with it in a different way, then I get very upset. I shouldn't get upset if I know this is what's covering me. This is a disturbance to me as a pure devotee of Radhasham. This is what's standing between me and them. I want to get rid of it. When somebody comes up and corrects us or says something, we should, Jai, thank you. I've been waiting for this. Huh? Because it's taking it off, getting rid of it, getting rid of it. That's how we should see it. But because we're so attached, this is me, how dare you say anything about me? You know, then life becomes a problem. You know? And we actually get ourselves into a lot of difficulties by not being able to hear these things. I don't know about you, but many, many times I've had experience where devotees have been trying to tell me things and I just would not hear. And finally I got a really solid whack on the head. You know? Then I understood, but it was so much suffering that I had to go through to understand exactly the same thing as I could have learned in a very peaceful situation by listening to a well-meaning devotee years ago. How to discriminate? Real personality? The real personality? Even at the madhyam level, the dealings of a madhyam are such that they don't cause disturbance. It's a spontaneous, I'm not talking about kanista madhyams, but madhyam, madhyam and higher. With these people, they have a innate, spontaneous way of dealing with Krishna and his energies and his devotees. So there's no disturbance. Right? The way they do things just seems to flow. It's in tune with Krishna. So this is one very clear way we can understand whether it's modes at work or whether it's a superior, you know, an uncovering of the personality at work. The modes tend to create disturbance, sometimes subtle and sometimes gross, but there's always disturbance. We notice it very much and very easily when it's the lower modes. You know, somebody crashes into you at Mangalarti and, you know, like you experience it, or somebody treads on your foot or, you know, pushes your way through to pay their obeisances like that, then it's pretty obvious that you're dealing with the lower modes. The subtler ones are more insidious. You know, the subtler modes, like goodness, it's more difficult to actually deal with that. The other thing that we have to remember is that we do have to take external help to deal with this, because none of us are going to shake ourselves. You know, we're pretty comfortable with who we are and what we are. And, you know, it's not so easy to face up to things that are there that need to be dealt with. So it's always good to have an outside voice that's well-meaning, more advanced than us, can give us some guidance. Because we may think we're doing fine, but to the devotee community, they may think, my God, you know, where's this woman at? You know, so it always, that's why it's important. We may not, you know, it may not be our nature to associate socially. We may not be a socializer, but at least we should be in association with those who are serious and sincere and honest in devotional service, so that when we need it, we'll give the nudge in the ribs, hey, maybe you should do that a bit differently. Then we should be open to it. Any other questions? Yeah. I was even thinking. Yeah. Yeah. And that, of course, when you have that kind of refuge, like dead, you know, bodies, as then you have to be aware also that it attracts ghosts, lower beings, like that. But I mean, when you get into it, the whole society is so. I was even thinking, I mean, this sounds probably pretty perverse, but I was thinking the other day when I was in the bathroom, I was staying in MBT, you know, which looks very, very beautiful. The externals are very, very beautiful. But then, I don't know why I thought it, but all I could, I was in the bathroom and I was thinking that there's so many devotees living in this complex, and the whole, you know, the bed of this place is just stool. You know, there's all these pipes full of it. Just the whole undercurrent of it is stool. It's still, you know. But on top is, you know, flowers and I guess that. You know, so sometimes you just have these images, you know, that come through and remind you that when Prabhupada says that, you know, this material world is a toilet, the analogy starts to make sense. He says this place is a toilet, just do your work and get out, you know. But we find in the West that, you know, toilets are places of amusements these days. You have your TV, computer games. You know, you show off of books that you like to read. You know, so that's what we're actually doing. We're in a toilet and we're making, you know, trying to enjoy life in the toilet. But Prabhupada is saying, get out. Do your work and get out. So, you know, these last chapters are very, the essence of these last six chapters is how to get out. So we, you know, some devotees find them a little dry, but I actually find them essential in terms of sambandha gyan, in terms of coming to terms with who I really am and the mess I'm in now and how to get out of it. You know, they're very powerful chapters. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Yeah, this is a nice question. Prabhupada is saying here that this is far, far superior to any other knowledge that we have. So does that mean that it's superior to the bhakti chapters? One of the difficulties with the Western mind is that we always divide things and then we put them into categories from bad to good. Isn't it? It's just a tendency we have as Westerners to do like that. But when we talk about three sections of Bhagavad Gita, we have to remember also the unity that is there and how they're all it's a progressive momentum that's building up in these chapters. Not that they're three separate units, but rather they have their place to play. So here, my understanding is, you may like to check with other devotees, but my understanding here about this is that it's one thing to have the knowledge, it's very wonderful to have the knowledge, but then you have to have the operation principles. You have to have you have to know how to operate it. So there's that story in Chaitanya Charitamrita of the boy who's very, very wealthy. His father has left him a huge wealth, but he doesn't know about it. He doesn't know how to access it. So an astrologer comes and tells him, you have this wealth. Fine, it's wonderful, but how do I get it? You see? So it's one thing to have the knowledge, pure devotional service, great. Yeah, I'm this, I'm that, great. But then how to operate and put the thing into practice so you get the result you want. So it's like a key. That's a very good analogy, thank you. Yeah, it's like a key. So, you know, you may get to the door of Golok, you know, but if you don't have the key, what's, you know, you've got problems. Of course, the key is Guru Shraddha, faith in Guru, and the parampara that you're coming through. But, yeah, so this, that's how I understand it, that you have to be able to operate it, the knowledge. Otherwise, what is the value of it? You know, that's what amazes me, that devotees can go to Radha Kund and take, you know, Siddha Pranali initiation. Okay, they know they're a peacock or a mandri, but what's the value of it? How do they operate that? They don't have the qualification. They don't know the process, you know. So what is the value of it? It's like being told that, you know, my, you know, great-great-great-grandfather was, you know, the one who invented Rolls-Royce, you know. So what? It doesn't make any sense. It has no value. The knowledge has no value. It's not operable like that. So that's why, you know, those that are wanting to do things cheaply, they're not interested in Bhagavad Gita. They have no knowledge, no interest in Bhagavad Gita, except for rustic editions of it, which have their place. But for us, at our level of understanding, we really need the Sambandha Gyan. We need it because we're so connected to the material energy. We're so connected to the illusion that this body is me. We can't go any further without this. It's hard work. It's hard work dealing with this kind of knowledge because it means that there has to be transformation of character. We have to apply it. But it's essential. Any other questions? A lot of questions in one question there. In terms of instruction, direct instruction, that was a lot more prevalent in the 80s, even early 90s, but there's been such a break of faith and also a reality check for a lot of the gurus. So where there isn't that faith, I see it also now and I'm enlivened by it, I see that where disciples have firm faith in the guru, he does take a major and decisive role in helping them shape their lives and, you know, put themselves in positions where they will be purified quickly. But if there's not that faith, and trust, then usually not only gurus, but any senior devotee is not going to say something direct, because it will mean disturbance and animosity. So it won't usually be said. In terms of the secondary question about how do we take feedback, without ego. I know personally that most of the time, what could be called the most brutal kind of feedback has actually been the most beneficial. And if you understand and keep in mind that nothing happens without the sanction of Supersoul, and sometimes pain is very purifying, then it has its place. I'm not suggesting that we act like that. I'm not suggesting that we act brutally in our dealings with devotees. But we do experience sometimes that devotees are brutal. Their words are very harsh, especially with devotees who have very, very strong sadhana. I don't think they're aware of it. Devotees who chant 64 rounds a day, very, very strict in their practices, they don't realize the Brahman Tejas, or the potency of their speech to cut. So, when they speak strongly, it really cuts through the knife like anything, and it can be experienced as a very brutal attack, But, if you have the good fortune, I had the good fortune to experience that recently, and if you can accept it in a mood of pridelessness and, that after all I am a fallen offender, I have a lot to learn, then if you accept it in that mood, you'll be amazed how much it opens the heart and softens the heart. It is always difficult to keep your heart open and soft because it's so easily bruised. But Sasrupa Maharaj used to always preach to me that, that's part of becoming a pure devotee. That interaction. So, putting ourselves at risk for purification. It's not easy. It's not pleasant sometimes. But, like that. But if you find that the ego is so strong and so it's got you so bound that you can't take that, then you can take it the slow way. You can avoid correction. You can, be a pretender, do things very superficially in your dealings with others, not seek correction. And as you say, that also works, because if you're following the process, we do drop so many subtle bodies. This is one of the reasons you find so many upheavals in the lives of devotees. That, the materialists, they keep the same subtle body, basically, unless they have, some major change happen. They keep the same body, subtle and gross. It sort of goes along as a package together. And they drop it at the end and get a new one. But because of the process we're following, we're dropping so many subtle bodies, so many, many births we're getting rid of constantly if we're dynamically following the process. So it also works. You can also do it that way. Depends what you can handle, realistically speaking. But we always have to remember with transcendental life that the indirect is the most powerful. So you may have that desire. So if you're praying for it and crying for it, Supersoul will arrange. We think that we have to approach. But sometimes prayer, heartfelt prayer, will do the work. And that's far safer course, because then Supersoul is making the external arrangements, not us. The other thing that I find quite disturbing, and it's something that we have to deal with as a society, is that we are very much in the illusion that only sannyasi gurus are advanced. I'm not suggesting that but we have a tendency to think if I want superior help, if I want, guidance in my spiritual life, I have to go to somebody in orange who carries a stick. I sort of feel that we have to come to terms with this, that there are many advanced devotees in this movement who are in the Grihastha ashram, in the Brahmachari ashram. Two of the most advanced people I know are Brahmacharis. Like, talking international level of advancement, two of the people I find to be most advanced are simple Brahmacharis. Sleep on the floor, mix with the local devotees, go to the full morning program. So Yes, you can very easily. They're very approachable. You know, so like we have to sort of really, in looking, this is what I mean about stepping out of the problem and looking at it, you know, separately. This just take this one. I don't feel that I have facility to advance senior devotees and, you know, directly get their association and assistance in my spiritual life. Perhaps we could take that as a problem. So then we have to start, we step outside of that and we have a look at it. Maybe there are things in our mindset that prohibit us understanding who is advanced and who can help. Maybe we have a particular mindset that blocks out certain realms. That's one possibility. The other thing is that we may have preconditioned ideas about who we are and how much we're prepared to share with others. We may have an us that is for others and an us who is ours. And we may not want others to know that. We may be for insecurity, maybe pride, maybe so many reasons. So, you know, like, it gets a little bit tricky and a little bit embarrassing, but you're alone when you do it, so it's no problem. But if you take the time to introspect occasionally and just step outside of the situation and say, what are the influences affecting this? And we're looking at internal. We're talking about your mind, you know, your conditioning. We're going to look at this in more depth tomorrow from Uddhava Gita. All these things, all these influences are there. So, you know, the externals, we learned that in the 13th chapter, that the externals are part of our field of activity. They're a result of us, our desiring, our doing. There is nothing outside of that. So if there are things that we don't like, we can't handle, we should be looking inside. That's the bottom line. We should be looking inside. Everything that's outside is a projection of what's here. So we have to look at that. There are other circumstances that we may have to come to terms with that come up, and this is where we have to be very kind in our dealings with ourselves and with other devotees. For example, may have had a trouble with, say, just take something that's basic for all of us, sex life. We may have had a trouble with this for many, many births. We may have been a devotee for many, many births, but had a basic trouble with this one thing, sex life. You know, I just have a preoccupation with it. We may have that problem. And then we decide we want to get serious. Even our body may show that that's where we're at. We have been at for many births. Even our body may be constituted in that way. But then we decide, I don't want to know about it anymore. I don't want to know about it anymore. But then we have to deal with all that backlog. So if we're not introspective, we may start to get caught up into the same cycle again. It takes a lot of strength to stand firm and say, cut, this is it. I'm not going to continue the cycle. This is it. This is one of the biggest things we have to overcome in our dealings, like being embodied, is this sexual attraction. If we can deal with that, somehow or other get on top of that one, we're halfway home. This was explained by Prabhupada in the 7th verse today. So, you know, it really gets down to the bottom line, and we have to decide, we have to be honest, and we have to be detached in looking at ourselves and, you know, look at it as an observer, an objective observer, what we're dealing with. If you take time out to do this regularly, it helps so much. Haha, this is a very interesting point. We'll have to be quick. We'll have to be quick too because we get kicked out soon. But this is a very interesting point. What do you do when somebody who you don't feel knows you very well has something to say about you? You know, and the ego comes up a little bit. Is that basically it? Yeah. So what do you do with this? Now, of course, we have to be, we'll give more weight to someone saying something if they're in knowledge. And in essence, in like when we're talking real reality, they don't have to know us as people. They just have to have a working knowledge of the Shastra. Because what we think is us is actually a conglomeration of the modes, and that has certain tendencies and symptoms. So actually someone who's very expert, even in Bhagavad Gita, if you're expert in Bhagavad Gita, you can look at somebody the way they speak, the way they carry themselves, the way they deal with someone, and you know them well. Isn't it? So the ego may try and defend you by saying, I'm not going to listen to this. This person doesn't know me. How can they say that? They don't know me. But if they are advanced in knowledge, even they know Bhagavad Gita very well as a working knowledge, not theoretical, but working knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, they know you better than you know you probably. And what they say, you should think carefully about. Because the trouble with us is that we have one way of looking at things. And if things don't fit into the pattern, then that's not me. So somebody comes in this way, we say, forget it. But maybe we have to think about it from this way to understand it. Otherwise, we're going to keep the wheel going. That's kept us here for birth after birth after birth. It's going to keep churning. Maybe it needs something to come in from this side to stop it. Just a thought. We will have to stop here, otherwise I'll be in trouble. Yeah, because you're not doing it according to Krishna's system. I mean, if you... The motive is important. But it's not... The mood is not that we have to find somebody perfect to tell us something. We can learn from anybody. That's given in Bhagavatam. Anyone who's more advanced of, we should be prideless enough to be able to take shelter and take some guidance from them. If we're waiting for Mr. Perfect to come and tell us, we're going to be waiting a long time. Where is the Uttama? Where is the Uttama that will come to us? Give us the time. Uttamas don't come down. Well, they do come down, but then they're madhyams. They will take on qualities. Yeah. That's a very good point. This is a very valuable point, that the adhika, we have to have the adhika. If we don't even know how to ask the right questions, then Krishna's going to send us someone who can answer with the questions that we are asking now. It's not that we can expect an uttama to come down in the form of a madhyam to deal with us who are not qualified to hear. So we have to bring ourselves up. The adhika has to be there from our side also. Because otherwise these advanced souls won't interact with us. If there's not the adhika, they won't interact. They'll be polite, social, but they won't seriously interact. Okay, we better finish, otherwise I'm going to be in big trouble. Who's the satellite manager?